feeling that this is going to be a two-part talk on the seven factors of enlightenment or awakening. Can you hear? Okay. The ancient Buddhist teachings, the liberation teachings, are like a deep sacred well. And they're very pure. It's like the pure water in a deep sacred well. And they're meant to be really heartening, that we can access this inner wisdom that's inside all of us, that we don't have to go outside of ourselves at all to find peace. So another way to say this is, it's not only very heartening, but it's deeply reassuring. What we're learning to do is access this deep inner wisdom and peace. We're not trying to make it happen through willpower or striving. And sometimes the seven factors of awakening are presented side by side with the factor, with the hindrances, the five hindrances. And so they're often presented as a battle between these very different forces of awakening and the obstacles that we face. So it's said that when the Buddha was sick, he would have these chanted to him all through his life because they were so uplifting for him. And it's said that, like, when somebody gives a talk about the seven factors, that the devas come, the celestial beings, because they love hearing them so much. So we're inviting the devas to come listen. So the five hindrances, sleepiness, restlessness, aversion, attachment, doubt, are considered the obstacles we have to learn how to work with the seven factors. It's like the seven factors helps us work with them to awaken. It's like we're awakening from being asleep at the wheel. So these forces of awakening, mindfulness is the first of the seven, and it's likened to the warp of a loom. So if you've ever woven or seen how weaving happens, I used to weave, the warp is the long threads that you thread the loom with. And then the weft are the threads that go horizontally back and forth. So the other six factors are considered the weft, and the warp is considered mindfulness, meaning that mindfulness has to be present with all of these, all the other six, for them to bring this light and awakening to the mind, heart. So we've talked a lot about mindfulness. I'll talk some more about it after I go through the list. The second is the next three, investigation, energy, and rapture are considered energizing factors. and calm, concentration and equanimity are considered the tranquilizing factors. And that's beautiful in and of itself, as you see that we need both energizing and tranquilizing. In the talk, I might not stay completely sequential tonight, and there is one model where you can present them quite sequentially, but they're not always, you know, it's not always a linear process. So, for example, it's mindfulness. The way Sayadaw Upandita would teach it, it's mindfulness. It brings us, he's a very energized teacher, so it's like mindfulness brings you face to face with the object, right? It's what I would translate as connecting. It's the attention. And I'll go into this much more, but in the sequence, it's very interesting because this ability to remember to be here, that remembering to be here and connecting, as you can see, without that, you're not here. You can't even, there's no possibility of waking up. And then the investigation is when the attention connects. The investigation, as I've mentioned a number of times, is this willingness not to know what something is conceptually. And it requires the renunciation of our arrogance. It requires enormous humility. It's pure research. Pure exploration. It's pre-research. It's dropping anything that you know about anything conceptually, because the truth is that every moment is new. Every breath is new. Every sound is new. And so you can't possibly know what's going to happen next. Of course, we want to know what's going to happen next. In fact, you go out to do walking, and almost the whole walking can be, what's next? You know, what's next? What's, you know, whatever. It's like, wow, we're so caught in that need to know what's going to happen next. And investigation is the opposite of that. And it's non-conceptual. It's similar to pure research in a scientific way, but it's done experientially through a non-conceptual process, not through the thought process. It's through the direct experience. And so the Buddha taught, if you can connect the attention, remember to be here, that soft readiness or intention to understand rather than to judge, and I'll add in a little more into this in a few minutes, then there's this willingness to not know, to be humble. And as we've been saying, to let the experience emerge wordlessly. When we can sustain that a while, energy will happen. Energy. You're not commanding these to happen. You're not making it happen. It's Upandita gave a translation of this that knocked me out in such a profound way. He called it courageous energy, virya, courageous. And so it's the courage. He was so energizing. It's that courage it takes to not only come face to face with what's happening, but to explore it with this humility. And when we do, this energy appears. It's the courage to keep sustaining that humility. And then it said that if we, this is all a matter of like, sometimes you see, sometimes there's enough energy to sustain it. And then it said that joyful interest will appear. And this joyful interest is translated as the deep delight in the truth. How can you not love this? No wonder the devas come along and want to hear it, because it's so inspiring, this deep delight in the truth. And this is so critical, because it's the truth of how things are, not wishful thinking. Right? So deep delight in the truth includes pleasure and pain. And this is so significant, because it's when we start shifting the investigation isn't just about investigating pleasure and what we want or what we think should be or what should be. It's all about what is, not what we want to get. So the deep delight in the truth is when you break the pleasure-pain chain. We have this chain around our neck. It's prison. And this shift to being interested in pleasure or pain is joyful. You're free, right? You're not no longer imprisoned. This is so significant. The deep delight is coming from that feeling that, oh my, you know, it's like, wow, you're interested in aversion. Genuinely, not fake. It's a genuine interest. It's so profound. If you've experienced that once, you come back to a retreat because you get how important it is. You get what, you know, what we're not here. When something comes back that you thought you got rid of, it's the best teacher. And it's usually painful. Because I always ask that question when that, you know, it's usually lower back pain. I've had it since 1979. You'd call it chronic, but sometimes it does go away. And when it comes back, there's always that moment where it's like, I thought I got rid of it, right? You know, of course I have that feeling with it. I thought I got rid of it. And then it's like, do I want to be free? Or do I want to be stuck in this aversion? Well, the lower back pain teaches me everything about what freedom is. It's a great teacher. We all have something like this. You can't escape it. You're human. We're born into a world of joy and sorrow, pleasure, pain. So this PT is very significant, and it's one of the ones that you just really can't command. You know, it's just like there that you just have to wait till the energy builds, which is why again, I'll remind us all, why do we not go food shopping? Why do we not talk? Why do we not do this? Why do we not do that? It's out of great kindness for ourselves that we conserve energy. Renunciation is out of deep kindness and care. So it's the greatest conservation effort. I remember when I really started to understand this, I wanted to make a bumper sticker that said, split your own atoms. You know, it's like energy, you know, how much are we running around, right? We need nuclear power plants, do we? Some people say so. But if you start getting a sense of what the seven factors are, you'll see that it's all about the best conservation efforts you could ever make. But with the joyful interest, I always like to point out that the image of the Buddha, the statues, which came 500 years later after the Buddha lived, which is very significant. The image is based on the Greek god Apollo. Interesting. And the imagery is interesting in that you don't see the Buddha got stuck at joyful interest. you don't see that an over-exuberance. You don't see that energy hitting a huge voltage and it's like a rocket going up. Well, that rocket is very balanced. Look at the image. That smile is so sublime. It's so balanced. It's so deep. It's like that smile is almost so deep inside, the smile barely gets up to the surface. Yeah. It's so peaceful. So how does that happen? Calm, concentration, equanimity. So when we have all this energizing practice, it can create a lot of voltage. And a lot of the practice is learning how to regulate that voltage through the calm, concentration, equanimity. When these factors come into balance, or even if there's a few, but when they're in balance, when the equanimity starts to develop, it's called holy equanimity. Holy equanimity because it's peace, unconditional peace. It's without conditions, unconditional acceptance. So sometimes the mind of a fully enlightened being, an arahant, is described as six-limbed equanimity. It's beautiful. So when you get a sense of the moment-to-moment six sense door awareness practice, and you see that sometimes there's peace at every sense door. A sound appears, there's equanimity. A sensation in the body appears, it's equanimity. That's peace. A thought appears, it's just thinking. That's peace. Well, an arahant is supposed to have that down. It's amazing just to imagine that we're capable of that. Peace at every sense door, every moment. Wow. And that is so powerful because it affects the stars. It affects every being everywhere, that peace. It's the end of the war. It's the end of the war or battle between the hindrances and the seven factors. And so a description I'd like to give it this, I would usually wait till the end of the retreat, but the end of this talk or the end of the series. The idea of this deep equanimity is it holds everything. So it's like effort is okay and effortlessness is okay. One doesn't get attached to effortlessness, right? It's like both are skillful or sick, healthy. One relates to them equally because there's this total peace. And I love to deep, ordinary, conceptual, not conceptual, struggling, not struggling. You know how you hit a place in practice and you're not struggling, and then you think that's how it should be all the time. That's not peace. You hit an effortless place and you think, well, that's how it should be all the time. That's not how it is. Yeah, etc. But it's like we talk about being okay as we are, and then we reject needing reassurance. That's not peace. Everything we need is already within us. Then we get back into longing, right, for more. And you learn that both are totally okay. It's the mindfulness. It's this, it's how you're relating to them. And if you're taking them personally, there's no peace. You're fighting, right? You're at war. Boundless metta, hating everything. With a peaceful mind, there's no problem. No problem whatsoever. It's just hating everything, not buying into it at all. Can you imagine living like that all the time? I could go on, but you get the point. We all taste that sometimes in practice. One of the things I got fairly early in this practice when I was cooking for Mahasi Sayadaw was that I love that the means and the ends are the same in this practice. It's just the same practice, whether you're doing the same thing, whether you're like a beginner or an old student. It's the same stuff. The only difference between somebody who comes in here new and has been at it 40 years, it's the same experience. It's sleepiness, restlessness, aversion, attachment, and doubt, right? That's the obstacle. Everyone shares it. So the people up here sitting in front have the same obstacles. Mahasi Sayadaw, the Buddha, everyone, the Dalai Lama, it's all the same stuff. So it's a battle until there's no battle. And you'll experience no battle here at times. And it's very inspiring. It's like, whoa. You get it. And then you forget. Of course. That's why mindfulness is remembering to be here. It's that. It's the beginning of that process. It's like, where did the attention go? Wow. Did you make it go wherever it went? Could you control it? And this is fundamental to the understanding of mindfulness, that you just can't do it and get the PhD and be done. That's what we want. We want that little piece of paper on the wall that said we did it, and then we move on. But it's not like that, and it takes time to get that. That it's just like, this is your life. Each moment you got, are you going to try to wake up with it or go to sleep with it? That's the only option. Asleep, awake, asleep, awake. I used to have, so for some years, my soft mental note was lost here, lost here, until I stopped judging it. Technically, when you notice you're lost, you're not lost anymore, but I would still note it. It's that lost here, lost here, lost here. The more you fight that, the less energy you have. And this is what you learn as you do the practice. If you're judging that your attention goes off, after a while, you got to go to bed. It's just exhausting. But if you have that sense that, great, I'm back, right? It's the attention has come back. That's everything. Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj in the book I Am That said, to reach the deeper layers of suffering, you must go to its roots and uncover their vast underground network, where fear and desire are closely interwoven, and the currents of life's energy oppose, obstruct, and destroy each other. The question then is, the questioner said, how can I set right a tangle which is entirely below the level of my consciousness? And he said, by being with yourself, watching yourself with alert interest, with the intention to understand rather than to judge, with full acceptance of whatever may emerge, because it is there. This is so incredible. With full acceptance of whatever may emerge, merely, but I'm saying merely just, he didn't say that, because it's there. That's all we need to know. You encourage the deep to come to the surface and enrich your life and consciousness with its captive energies. This is the great work of awareness. It removes obstacles and releases energies by understanding the nature of life and mind. Intelligence is the door to freedom, and alert intelligence is the mother of intelligence. Very clear. That's the seven factors of awakening. And the hindrances, that's the battle. But it's done through what? The intention to understand rather than to judge. So with mindfulness as the warp, we've described many aspects of mindfulness, and I would like to just briefly go into a way that I have tried to describe it through this acronym I developed. But then I kept developing this this acronym, and it started with the R-A-I-N. A lot of you know that. And then it shifted to also D-R-O-P. So the acronym is RAINDROP. I did a course on this recently, an online course, and I wanted to describe it as, it got rejected, this description, but I love it. Boy, did they not like it. And I, it was fun. I said, would you rather be singing in the rain or drowning in the drop? And they just didn't like that at all. So R-A-I-N are, they nothing can cover what mindfulness is. It's just like, it's why the popularization of mindfulness is a little slightly disturbing, because it's being described as like so many without depth, one might say, without wisdom, one could say. So here's one description. R-A-I-N would be recognition. If recognition is present, mindfulness has a chance. I would give it 50% of the battle, as my father would say. That's that more old-fashioned language, but it's true. It's like there's, okay, I'm going to explain. D-R-O-P are the opposites of R-A-I-N, so I better describe those first. So R, recognition, A, acceptance, I, interest, N, non-identification. D, the drop, drowning in the drop, D is the opposite of the R. So D is distraction or denial. There's more, I'll go into it, but it's the opposite, right? Recognition is, oh, hearing is happening, right? That's coming back, that's coming too from the sleep, right? Oh, breathing is happening. Whatever, it's like anything we notice, it's huge. Why? Because we're so used to spacing out. We're so used to that as a normal way of life, distraction, spacing out, denial, whatever. It's like the recognition is everything. And that's why the soft mental note is often our best friend. If we're really spacing out, you know how you can get to lunch without even knowing how you got there. The bell rang, Pavlov's dog, you know, ding, we go, right? And you find yourself eating and it's like, wow, how did I get here? But that's a lot of our life, you know? It's just like, well, how did we get there? Just standing up, just the ability to notice we're standing, it's huge. Well, a soft mental note, you know, it's like if I really want to at least stand a chance, I might say intention to reach here. You know, it's like I can do this automatic. It can be automatic. Or I can have a soft mental note touching. Very, very powerful. Important. Hardly anyone likes to do it anymore. It's not au courant, but it's useful. When you don't need it, you don't need it. When you need it, you really need it. For some period in my early years of practice and living with Steve in Honolulu, I used to make little signs like in the car dashboard. It said driving. Sign on the refrigerator, it said reaching. You don't see them after a while, but they're really helpful. Mirror in the bathroom, brushing your teeth. It's hilarious. It's like, who pays attention to brushing their teeth mindfully every night or morning or whenever? It's like, that's recognition, brushing. You know, it's that, this, why I say it's half the battle is how can you apply investigation, energy, joyful interest, calm concentration, and equanimity if we're not here? So it's this recognition, this waking up is so intensely important. And I recommend when you recognize something to see if you can relax and not try too hard. So it's like the ability to remember to be here happens only from remembering to be here. It's the consequence of remembering to be here happens because you remembered to be here. You can't control the next time you remember to be here, but anyone in this room could tell you that's practiced a long time that the more you remember to be here, the more you remember to be here. And the less you remember to be here, the less you remember to be here. And that's the way it is. So that's why you just can't get a diploma. It's a way of life. So when you remember to be here, hearing, for example, or knowing you're walking and you notice the stepping and the foot touching, whatever it is, eating, just, you know, you can make a soft mental note, chewing. There's so many possibilities, swallowing, tasting. But however it is, when we notice it, it's like to relax into the experience or be kind. It's like if you're kind, it's inviting to sustain the attention. If you're judging that you weren't here for 10 seconds, it's not inviting. Who would want to be here with our tendencies? Nobody. Our tendencies is to judge and be merciless and self-hatred or be wanting something else that isn't happening. Who would want to be here with our normal human mind? Nobody. No wonder we hardly want to remember to be here, but who's waiting for us? The grouch, or, you know, the greedy being, or whatever. It's like, no wonder we go away right away. There's no kind relationship. So you come back, and it's like, oh, can you be kind? Can you relax? Can you be kind? Not try too hard. Not give up. So recognition, I wonder if I'll get past recognition. Maybe not. Denial, distraction. One of my favorite things to teach about drop, I like teaching drop better than Ray now, because drop is what protects us. Drop is our defense. If we don't appreciate drop, again, it's hopeless. So distraction is our way of feeling secure. It's our way of not dealing with reality. If you don't have mindfulness in the Brahmaviharas, I'm trying to say, who wants to be here? Of course we don't. We're not protected. So when I describe the development of rain, you're more safe and protected. There's less need for control. When the seven factors of are there, there's peace, there's no need for control. So as drop unfolds, it's so much fun. So okay, there's recognition, acceptance, that the opposite of the acceptance is resistance. We've been talking about that a lot, right? Resistance is when we say, no, this isn't happening, I don't want this to be happening, right? It's so painful, because guess what? It is happening. The resistance is just our attempt to what? Protect ourselves. We believe we can control what can't be controlled. It doesn't mean that I can't move this piece of paper over here. That's not what the Buddha is talking about. It doesn't mean that I can't brush my hair. This isn't the level of control we're talking about. How about the weather? Now there's a good place to notice how little control we have. Well, mostly our moment-to-moment experience is more like the weather. What's the weather report? I like to play when I'm on retreat, like, okay, what's the weather report today? It's looking kind of cloudy. You know, it's like, you got to have some humor. Little squalls are happening today. You know, it's just, The Buddha taught that it's the resistance to whatever's happening that's so painful. It doesn't matter what the experience is. And just to remind everybody, acceptance doesn't mean condoning. It's not like we're agreeing with hunger in the world. It's by accepting that I have this chronic back pain, I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying that's what's happening. Can I relate to it well? So this is a huge difference. I think we're so afraid that if we accept something painful, it means we're agreeing with it. Acceptance does not mean agreement. It means agreement with reality. R-A-I. Often I've seen that people tend to try to go to interest without accepting. It's more and more clear now as I'm teaching, you know, and seeing it in myself. It's like we'll have something painful and we'll want to be interested in it, but we forget that first we have to maybe try accepting it, you know. And it's really an interesting place of practice. Interest is... it's such a shift. Anytime you notice that shift to when you can be interested in what's happening, the opposite, D-R-O, is obliviousness. I wanted to put a B there, but it doesn't fit in the drop. The B is boredom or apathy. Drap wouldn't have worked either. So a lot of the practice, when the energy is a little low, is accepting that interest isn't there. And it's just, again, putting in your time and trusting that the energy will build. If you're not trying to make it happen, it will. And then the interest will be often a result of enough energy. And the best example of this is a child. I happened to be walking up in the orchard yesterday, and some father came by with two children, and the laughter of these kids. I mean, I kind of wanted to lay on the ground and just laugh because it's so infectious. But they were just laughing about, you know, the flowers and the grass, and, you know, children, why are they having, you know, this intensity of experience? It's interest. Why? Don't you wish you had I'm 66. It's like if I had a fourth of their energy, I'd feel like, you know, completely different at this point. You know, children have so much energy, but they don't have the wisdom. But they certainly are a good example of interest. They're interested in everything. That's why, you know, the parent's so tired. You know, when you have a two-year-old, you're like, ah! Couldn't you not be interested in that, right? It's just, they're interested in everything. How do we lose that? Well, we're putting all our energy into being an adult and functioning. But the practice is one of starting to make a decision. You start making decisions. What are you going to put your energy into as you get older? Because it's not limitless. So, as we go through these, you know, there's so much to say, I guess I was going to try to go through it quickly, but the opposites are something to be mindful of. You know, they're to accept, they're a defense. So resistance is not, we've been talking about it for so long, but it's not to think of as a problem at all. It's just to say, oh, the system is, it's like the iris of the eye. It opens and closes. And if it, why does the iris close? There's not a, you know, why is it open? I'm not going to answer that. You guys know it. It's like, but it's the same with our system. If there's not enough R-A-I-N, then D-R-O-P will happen. And there's more and more need for the defense and the control because there's less and less R-A-I-N. So when you get to the N, it's actually one of the hardest things to teach. N is non-identification. But it's fun to have a drop to explain it with because the P, the opposite, is personification. It's that feeling that experience is mine. Possessiveness. The P goes a long way in this one. Personification. It's that sense that we're taking, you know, when you take the weather personally, it doesn't make any sense. But that's what the P is, that we're taking it personally, and we're not seeing that it's that identification that's so painful. It's that mine, it's my fear. It's just like saying it's my squall or my rain. You know, my snowstorm. It's the same thing. It's just the weather. So very important with back to the recognition, no matter how much no matter how sharp our attention or clear it is, it's still not going to be able to control reality. That's not the point. Another way to work with the non-identification, it's related to anatta, that as you explore the investigation, there are times when you understand how insubstantial whatever appears is. And it's out of that understanding of how insubstantial, how caught we are in like wanting pleasant food, but if you really chew it and taste it, wow, it's very different than our idea of it. It goes quickly. It's very insubstantial what we get so attached to. Wow. When I moved to the Big Island in 83, fairly quickly I went over with Steve to the Big Island and went many times, but moved over there around 15 years ago. And what struck me the first time when I was on the island was the vastness of the lava fields. There's a volcano, an active volcano on that island, and it's so new, that island, that it's every time I would land there and drive wherever I was going or be driven, it would stop my mind. It just stops my mind. I can't tell you how it shifts from feeling like the earth is solid to visually being almost assaulted with the fact, but it's oppressed, but it's really, you cannot deny that this earth is in change. It's not solid at all. And I have so many stories about this, so that's why I'm kind of waiting, because it's like, just for example, right now, Kilauea, the volcano is going off again, like right now. And just to describe, this one neighborhood has been evacuated, but it's very interesting. Like 3 days ago, it's like, it makes me laugh, but it's not that funny if you live there. So please, sometimes I laugh when something's so bad, it's funny, right? But 3 days ago, like, you could, in this neighborhood, you could kind of walk outside your door and or go out on the road. The road is a better example, and it started to get cracks, right? But it would be on your lawn or wherever, there were starting to be cracks. And, you know, that could be disconcerting, right? You know? And then the next day, that was yesterday, there was smoke coming out of these cracks. And then today, it just turned into rivers of lava, you know. You know, it's maybe 2,000 people have been evacuated now from that area. So there's no one's going to get killed. Some people will probably lose their houses. But it's just, to me, there is something so important in that, in terms of our sense of solidity. And, you know, it's part of the practice is this exploration of who am I? But it's not just who am I, it's who are you. But who is anything? What is anything? This is the research I'm talking about. If you aren't going through the filter of aversion and attachment, wanting to get something, that's not pure research. That's not pure exploration. Wanting to get rid of, avoiding, etc., all of that. It's like, but if you start to just notice what's apparent, for right now, if you bring your attention really into your hand and you don't get lost in the visual image, it's very insubstantial. What do you feel? What do you experience? Not hand. we can say, try experiencing maybe the word heaviness or pressure, or you might feel temperature or something, but you can't experience hand. But this is the same with the word aversion or fear or earth. It's like, and there is a grief process in this. There is a disenchantment process in this. This is why the people have been here and you've been doing the Brahma Viharas and you kind of shift to, you know, how things are. It can be a bit of a... I remember when I did that practice for a long time and then shift to equanimity, I thought, oh my God. It was like going from addiction to sober, like in seconds. It's so real. And that it's like that sense of any kind of wishful thinking or embellishment, that's this embellishment we're doing. And a lot of it is visual. This is hence, Steve has been so helpful for all of us over the years to keep bringing it back to what is the experience in your body with fear. What is your experience in your body with anger? Because if it just stays in the head, you probably won't really see it clearly. So one time I was doing a retreat in 1986 with Sayadaw Upandita. We set up a retreat on that side of the island, and 86 was when Kilauea went off. It's been going off ever since, and I'd never seen it. And I was a yogi, and my friend was cooking that retreat, and I was so intrigued. I talked her into, this was being a bad yogi. This qualifies as bad yogi. I talked her into driving me up to get closer to it and to try to find some binoculars. So she was like, are you sure? You know, she didn't want to get in trouble, but I'm like, yeah, I'm really sure. I'm positive. And we went up at like 2 a.m. And it was one of the most significant moments of my life. I'd only seen the black lava fields. You know, you can grasp what happened there, of course, but seeing that liquid fire validated something so deep inside me. It validated anger. It was like it validated this energy in me that I'd been taught was so wrong and bad and not to be felt. And I looked at it was instantaneous. It was like, oh, this energy can be very destructive and very damaging in this world. Incredibly. And it can be very creative. It's creating Pele, the goddess, the fire goddess, the volcano goddess. She's creating the island. She's creating more land again right now. But it's going through some people's houses, right? My favorite thing about Pele is that you can't control her. If she's going to go right through your house and burn it down, she's going to do it. There's no stopping her. It's cool. You know, it's just like, of anything you can ever see, try to stop a volcano. But it's something that happens inside of us. It's the same energy. And it builds. I want to go through it again. Unpleasant, disliking, irritation, annoyance, frustration, aversion, rage, war. Now, my father could do that in about 2 seconds. Some people it might take hours, right? People are different types, but what matters is the acceptance of that energy without getting caught in the story. And this is the same with attachment, I don't have time to go through the sequence, but it's so... This is where the Buddha taught we can be free. Do you want to be angry or do you want to be free? Do you want to be caught in the story and repeat it endlessly? And it's like you can be the judge, the jury. You can send someone to prison. whatever, right? You know, you can see when you're angry, you get righter and righter and righter and righter, and you haven't directly experienced the anger. And there's no wisdom. But if you start to, as Steve has been so brilliant over the years of saying, connect with your body, and I just notice the beginning of the volcano. And if I notice the irritation or this dislike, guess what doesn't happen? It doesn't go off. It doesn't lead to blame of others, self-blame, or the repetition of the story, because I've let that weather front come through. And then in daily life, it's a matter of deciding, is this energy telling me something I need to do something about? It's a very important emotion. It's discernment. But on retreat, most of the time, it's really learning how to work deeply, to learn how to connect with the experience and notice it directly like you would a physical sensation. And it comes and goes by itself, just like the sound of a bird. And this is peace, this is freedom. And this is possible with anything that you're afraid to experience. Anything that you need to control or afraid to experience has great power over us. The Buddha said, there's no greater happiness than peace. So let's sit for a minute. There's a great chant that the Buddha taught. All conditioned things are arising and passing away. Understanding this is the greatest kind of happiness, which is peace. I'll just chant it once. It's very beautiful. Anicca vata sankara upatavaya damino upakituva niruchanti desam upasumo sukho.